Well, this hour, we'll take your phone calls with Andrew Collins as we talk about ancient civilizations. It's truly incredible work. Incredible. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, back with Andrew Collins, as we're going to take your calls this hour as well about his truly incredible work. What would you say, Andrew? Would you say the unrecorded cave discovery beneath the Giza pyramids was probably one of the most magnificent things you've discovered, or is there anything else out there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, that was my Tutankhamun's tomb moment, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You know, Howard Carter looking into the tomb and saying, what can you see? And they says, wonderful things. That was my wonderful things moment.
Why did the Egyptians get so upset when a foreigner discovers these things? Because do they think they're the ones that should, because they're there?
It's simply national pride, isn't it, ultimately? And I mean, you know, one can understand that, of course, because people coming in from all parts of the world doing this research and getting the acclaim for discoveries, it's something that they clearly want to do themselves. And in Egypt now, most teams are headed by an Egyptian Egyptologist now. You know, there are very few that are actually under the leadership of European or American or, you know, even Asian, you know, leaders anymore, simply because they know that the next big discovery they want to make themselves.
Don't you think under the cloak of darkness they probably went down and found some stuff, either in what Schrock discovered or what you might have discovered, that they've already been down there and... You know,
you mean
pulled it apart
underneath the plateau at Giza?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of rumors and stories about things being found and taken out in the middle of the night, whatever. And I'll be honest, a lot of it is you know, conspiracy theories. I mean, you know, the people that are in charge of it, interesting enough, are very interested in finding it. I mean, somebody like Zahi Hawass. You know, he's been much maligned by, you know, the outside world, but he himself believes strongly that there is some kind of hidden chamber to be found, some kind of secret chamber. He associates it with, you know, his own, you know, Egyptian-Arabic background, and he himself originally was part of the Casey Foundation, or certainly
okay,
financing him.
Sure.
As was Mark Lerner, who is one of the leading archaeologists working at Giza at the moment. He too started off as a member of the Edgar Casey Foundation, was funded by them through Penn State University. And yet, once he got to Egypt, he realized that a lot of what Edgar Casey said was more something of the heart as opposed to something that he could see in terms of hardcore archaeological evidence. So he actually sort of went against a lot of the original ideas, including one book he actually wrote all about Edgar Casey, ancient Egypt, Atlantis, and what we call Egypt's elder civilization, which many people existed there around 10,500 BC.
Andrew, why is there so much awe surrounding Göbekli Tepe in Turkey? Tell me what's so special about that area.
I think that, as you know, my colleague Graham Hancock has said, I mean, it's like the smoking gun of a lost civilization, because here you've got incredible technical sophistication and a knowledge of art and of organization going on at the end of the last ice age, around 9,500 BC. And it's all there, complete. You know, it's like some kind of time capsule in a way, of what we were doing back during that age. And what it tells us is that there was a cosmology and an understanding of technology that must have already been many thousands of years old by the time we reached Göbekli Tepe. And the question then becomes, where did all of this knowledge come from?
Yeah.
I mean, some people would like to think that it came from Atlantis, but my own research has shown that this knowledge may well have been handed to us on a plate by the forerunners of humanity that existed on the Eurasian continent as much as 45,000 years ago. And I talk here about the so-called Denisovans. These were a type of human being that existed before us, before we entered into these same territories and, you know, reached as far as Australia. The Denisovans had been up and running for many hundreds of thousands of years. And you've only got to look at some of their, you know, their advanced technologies, like the so-called Denisovan bracelet, which I would urge, you know, the listeners to look up immediately, to see the sophistication of these people as much as 45,000 years ago. And, I mean, for instance, they created the first needles, the first bone needles, which they used to tailor clothing. They created the first musical instruments. They created the first horse riding. It's been suggested they rode horses. They created the most sophisticated stone tool technologies, which they would then pass on to our earliest ancestors who reached that same area 30 to 40,000 years ago. And I think that we inherited a lot of their legacy, and we brought that into Southwest Asia and places like Göbekli Tepe. And from Göbekli Tepe, it went down into Egypt to create the Pyramid Age.
Something happened on this planet over the years that completely obliterated this knowledge, passing it through. Something happened, don't you think?
Yes, I think it was a huge, great comet impact that occurred initially around 10,800 BC and devastated large parts of the Northern Hemisphere, North America particularly. And it lasted on and off for about 1,200 years. I mean, it created a mini ice age, which is known as the Younger Dryas, which did not end until 9,600 BC, just before Göbekli Tepe was created. You know, in many ways, what Göbekli Tepe is some kind of echo of what had gone on at the time of this cataclysm. Much of the art that's there is somehow reflects that you know, that cataclysm that had taken place. And there is so much geological, climatological evidence of this event now that it's very difficult for it to be denied. And I think that we lost a lot of our understanding at this time. We had to start again, you know, after this time. I mean, yes, Göbekli Tepe was there, and yes, in many ways, that helped create what's known as the Neolithic Revolution, which began from the area of Göbekli Tepe outwards. But we'd still lost a lot. But on top of this, we have the creation of these beautiful monuments like Stonehenge in Britain, which unquestionably is the end product of what started at Göbekli Tepe.
Let's take some calls here, Andrew, for you in our hour to go. Cheryl is with us in Seattle. Welcome to the program. First time caller. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, finally on. Wow. Thank you so much. I'm so excited about the program tonight.
Thank you.
I was wondering, do you think like Stonehenge and these other areas that they're figuring that's vibrational is landing pads and recharging whatever landed?
Interesting question, Andrew. Might they be landing pads for some of these UFOs or power stations to charge them back up?
I'll be honest. I have to be honest, I think. I don't see these as places where objects would be coming down from space to land. I see it more in terms of the objects coming out of the Earth at such sites and going up into the air. It's the opposite way round, because the ancients in the past were not looking specifically at the sky for these objects. They were looking at the ground. There would be certain locations, you know, most obviously hilltops, rocky outcrops, or certain specific places that had been, you know, marked as places where this phenomena would be released into the air and would then remain buoyant for minutes, maybe even longer than that, or, you know, disappear and then reappear. And it's this that I think that we might call today plasma UFOs. So I think it's more a case of going up than coming down.
Do you think they're physical and their origins are this planet?
I think that this planet helps create the portal for their arrival, if you like. Let's put it that way. But I think that we are talking about the correct geological conditions at a location that's allowing the manifestation, the creation of plasma. And once the plasma environment exists, you know, manifests as this light object, that something is able to enter inside it from a deeper level of existence. And although this might sound very New Age, it's actually not. This was something that was first theorized by a quantum physicist by the name of David Baum in the 1950s and 1960s. He spoke about, he did a lot of work with plasma, and he came to the conclusion that it actually acted as if it was alive. The term plasma itself, that's used for this so-called fourth state of matter, the reason why they called it this is because it looked so similar to the way that the body itself, the bodily plasma,
in our blood,
around
sure.
cells and blood, that this is why they called it that. It was alive. And I think that these plasma environments can be inhabited by intelligences that exist within what we might call the quantum field, or something existing outside of normal space-time.
Do crop formations have anything to do with this?
Well, I do. I mean, personally, I believe that most of the crop formations are made by human hands.
Sure.
However, there's a natural phenomena there, and it's been there for many, many hundreds of years, and was in the past associated with fairies, devils, and whatever else they thought might be creating these circles in the field. And the very earliest account that we've got, which comes from the 17th century, talks about fires being seen in the field at the time of the creation of a crop circle. So there's very clearly an association with what we call these plasma manifestations. So there's a relationship. And the place in Britain where all of these, not all, but many of the crop circles that appear each year is around Avebury. And this is obviously not very far. It's only about 10, 15 miles from Stonehenge. And strange lights have been seen in the same area for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, they were reported in the 17th century. They were reported again in the 18th century. So the very areas that the crop circles are appearing today are the same places where UFO lights, UFO encounters, and other stranger transformative experiences are still taking place. There's a relationship with all of this. Even if they are being made by human hands, people are being drawn to these areas for a reason. They feel a connection, a deep connection with the intelligences behind this phenomena. They feel that there's a whole relationship, and I think that the crop circles themselves are, signs of transformation. They're meant to affect us. You know, they're almost like automatic drawing, if you like.
Right.
Being inspired to be created.
Let's go to Joe in Monterey, California. Joseph, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
You're welcome, Joe.
I read a book a long time ago about Stonehenge, and the difficulty in moving those stones were incredible. It had to be something paranormal, if anything. They're not from that area. We have around the Earth a lot of different mineral deposits, and minerals are very powerful. The shape of these minerals, or the shape of objects, act like receiver transmitters, just like in electronics, your radio waves are captured by the shape of the antenna. When you put certain stones together, they create certain fields. Is there some similarity between the different structures, their shapes, the minerals? Because
Yes, there is, yeah. I mean, if you go to stone circles, the one thing that you will find is a lot of quartz. It seems as if the ancients deliberately sought out stones that had high incidence of quartz. Now, why? Well, the fact is that if you deform quartz and put pressure on it, it releases subatomic particles called electrons, and these electrons can create electromagnetic fields, and those electromagnetic fields will affect the human bodily system. They will affect, you know, the neurons. They will affect the firing of neurons with electron flows within the body. So there's going to be an effect upon us. But more than this, we talked earlier about sound and how low-frequency sound can affect the body. Well, at the very bottom end of this low-frequency sound is what's known as infrasound. And infrasound would also seem to be created through the generation of sound, you know, the creation of noise within these monuments. And this is going to affect the brain into thinking that there are, you know, that you feel presences, you feel you're not alone, you feel you're entering into an otherworldly environment. So all of this combined together creates the sense that you're entering into another reality when you're going into something like a stone circle, you know, or in the Great Pyramid. I mean, last year I did what I called the Great Pyramid Experiment, which is published online. And this, basically, we got people, I mean, a group of about 20, 25 people, all to put their sound recorders on their smartphones, on and synchronized, before we went into the Great Pyramid. Then everybody went into different rooms and made noises at different times with the idea that all of this data would then be examined by an engineer friend of mine to see what the interconnectedness was between all the different chambers to do with different frequencies of sound. And this created incredible results. There's a two-part article on ancient origins called The Great Pyramid Experiment, which you might want to read about this. But the generation of sound matched that of the human voice in various of the chambers. But in the bottom chamber, the subterranean chamber, it was very specifically attuned to create low-frequency sound and infrasound. And you can tell this. I mean, when you're in that room, you know, you have this sense that you're almost in another world, and any sound sounds like it's coming from somebody else, as if you're not alone. And that's the effect of infrasound. And I think that this is something that we're going to find more and more important, you know, not just at places like the Great Pyramid, but at the various sites around Stonehenge that we're examining right now to do with the impact of sound when they're created at these places.
What would these sounds sound like, Andrew? Like trumpets, or how would they sound?
Well, I mean, Dr. Trevor Cox, the guy that's just done all of the work from the University of Salford at Stonehenge, he said that you would be dealing with very low-frequency sounds.
And like low hums, right?
Like, you know, the Tibetans have these huge, great horns.
Yes.
You know, massive things, you know, several feet long. Well, they're called lures, L-U-R-S. And he thinks that the sounds that would generate that type of frequency would be something similar. So we're talking about very deep sounds.
Interesting. You know, hold on, Andrew. We're going to come back with our final segment and final calls. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about epidemics for a couple hours, and later on, conspiracies. That'll be our next Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, back with our final segment with Andrew Collins as we talk about his work. And you got to let us know when the second book is done, Andrew, this other book. I'd love to get you back on again to talk about it, okay? We'll do that.
It's finished now. I'm just doing the illustrations. Will be in by the end of the year, so it's out next year. So I'll be talking to you again then, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Let's go to Michael in Chesterfield, Missouri. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to talk briefly about a company called Inovio, who's an amazing DNA company that is working very hard inside this what we're going through right now. And, you know, I think they have a promise there. And I was just also wanting to ask if your guests had any certain animals that in Göbekli Tepe that also coincide with their movements or migration.
Animals?
Well, you know, everything that was carved into those stones had a certain position in from the way you were looking at it. So I would expect that maybe a migration of a duck or a hyena or a moose or anything it would have something to do in that location. And did it also get flooded over by, you know, Noah's flood?
Did they have any special animals during that era that they really kind of worshipped, Andrew?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's actually quite an interesting question because, you know, the symbiotic relationship between humans and animals in the past was something that we don't really understand today. They would have seen the flights of birds, particularly during their migrational periods, as very important to their own cycles in any one year, or even to their ongoing migrations themselves. And it would seem that certain types of birds would have been followed. I mean, for instance, the swan, geese also, these would seem to be very, very important. In other words, obviously, when they were flying north, the people would also try and fly, would go north because they would know that the weather was changing where the birds were flying back to. And obviously, when the birds were flying south, they'd know that the weathers were getting worse. Therefore, it would be time to migrate southwards. And this is something that happens, obviously, you know, every year when with the oncoming of winter and then the return of spring. But this would have, in itself, created human migrations. And there would have been this symbiotic relationship. So when we come to somewhere like Göbekli Tepe, we have to look at the different animals and say, well, what's special here? And there are certain animals that keep cropping up again and again. The fox, for instance, is seen on so many stones that it must have been of incredible importance there. There have been hundreds of fox bones found there, and it's been proposed that there must have been some kind of cult connected with the fox. So what does the fox represent? Well, it's a creature associated with tricksters, you know, just like coyote in Native American tradition. And the tricksters were seen to be able to create havoc and even destruction in the world. You'll find that right the way across the Eurasian continent, there are stories of large dogs or wolves or foxes that are represented in the sky by the tails of comets, and that they were seen as the visible manifestations of that which would bring destruction. And I think that what you have at Göbekli Tepe is evidence of fox shamanism, and that those individuals that, you know, were practicing this type of shamanism were quite literally keeping at bay the supernatural forces, the supernatural creatures that were thought to bring about cataclysm, something which quite clearly had devastated the world just before the time of Göbekli Tepe itself. The other big symbol at Göbekli Tepe is the vulture. You'll find the vulture on various stones. And this seems to be a symbol of the soul's journey from this world to the next. You know, there are various birds in the world that are used to symbolize soul flight, the swan being an obvious example, the goose, the thunderbird, eagle. But in the area of Göbekli Tepe, it was the vulture. The vulture was the ultimate symbol of the transformation of the soul from this world to the next. And it would seem as if this was associated not just with the death journey, but also with shamanism itself, that the shamans would adorn themselves in cloaks of feathers to make this transition from this world through altered states of consciousness into the perceived other world to deal with these supernatural creatures that were seen to be a threat to the world.
Let's go to Randy in Bakersfield, California. Thanks for holding, Randy. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. First off, George, I'd say thank you so much for what you do. And I work in the oil fields and spend a lot of nights having you keep me awake and entertained. I had a question for Andrew. In oil fields, we use seismic and electric stuff to find different oil, water, and gas underground. And I was always wondering if that was a process you could use or you guys have used when you're looking for, like, ancient artifacts, whether it's, you know, Egyptians or jewelry or whatever, all the kind of stuff you guys are looking for, like, outside of, I mean, I'm not educated, part of my ignorance, when it comes to finding those kind of things underground. And you were speaking of they don't like foreigners out there searching around. And I thought maybe if you guys use maybe more modern technology to try to find some of these hidden artifacts, hidden mummies and that kind of stuff. That's kind of a silly question, I know. But
no, not at all. Well, what do you use, Andrew?
Well, I mean, obviously there are different types of what they call remote sensing. You know, you can use radar, you can use the electrical currents of the earth, you can use magnetism. You know, there are devices and instruments that will detect changes within the earth itself that will tell you whether the earth's been disturbed or whether there's any kind of hollow cavities, caves, chambers, and things like this. And you can do this not just on the ground itself, but from the air, from satellites, or obviously, more increasingly these days, drones. Drones are being used for that purpose. I mean, and you can get incredible results. But I think that my main thought when we're talking about this is Giza, you know, and the plateau there and the area around the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and the Second Pyramid, you know, what really is down there? I mean, we've got satellite images that were taken at night using specialist radar systems that show us underground cave systems. I mean, you can plainly see them. You know, they appear like a dark shadow crossing the plateau, and they have nothing to do with, you know, roads or tracks or anything that's actually on the surface. So we know that you can use this remote sensing to see what's down there, but the problem is convincing the Egyptian authorities that they should take seriously the idea that they are looking for something extra special on the plateau. You know, even LIDAR, which is this sort of infrared sensing mechanism that's been used to discover cities in the jungles of Central America, and it's been used in Egypt as well, but not on the Giza Plateau itself. I mean, there's so much that can be done, and so many different really advanced, you know, mechanisms and devices that can be used, that we should be doing this, I think. But as I said, it's about convincing the Egyptian authorities that this is a priority.
Absolutely. Jonathan's with us in Hackensack, New Jersey. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Andrew. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So it's according to in 1993, Robert Duvall was the one who came out with the book, The Orion Correlation Theory.
Mm-hmm.
Where, and he made a lot of money with that book. And he's well known as the guy who came up or proposed the theory. And that was a big breakthrough. 2 years ago, I found a book at an estate sale called Collected English Poems of the English Language. And John Milton has a poem called On Shakespeare. Six lines, and in the middle of it, he's basically eulogizing Shakespeare. He must have been a big fan of him. And he asks, where should his bones be hidden in the ground? Perhaps under a starry pointed pyramid. And it's an interesting line to hear that was written in 1630.
Why would somebody want to be buried under a pyramid, Andrew? What's so mystical about that?
Well, I mean, the pyramid shape is something which was quite natural to Egypt. If you go into the desert to the west of the Nile, you will see these natural formations that, for all intents and purposes, could be mistaken for created pyramids. So the shape itself was already there within nature. It's also been suggested that, you know, the way that the sun's rays break through a cloud creates the shape of a pyramid, and that this would have been associated with the god Ra, the sun god, who was very, very important from the pyramid. Pyramid Age onwards. You know, and also the pyramid itself evolved from much earlier, more basic mound-like structures that we used.
Well, you keep up the good work, Andrew, and keep doing what you do. And as soon as that other book is finished, you come back on the program. Andrew Collins, of course, what a great, great researcher. You know, we're going through a lot with COVID, and I'm still getting lots of emails from people that are just thanking us for being on the air to help them get through some of this, but folks, don't have to thank us for it. That's what we do. We're very honored to be part of your program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.